It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, researchers are making new discoveries about Stonehenge that's shed light on the purpose of its famous stones and where its builders came from. We'll talk to WPR's Dave Potras, who's at the site, about what we're learning. First, the number of kids arrested in Wisconsin is declining, according to a new report, but that number seems to only be going down for white juveniles. The report from Race to Equity, which is a project of Kids Forward, found that black youth are three times more likely to be arrested in Wisconsin than their white peers. And for Native American kids, the rate is twice that of white children. Our next guest is here to talk about the findings in the report, what advancements have been made to the state's juvenile justice system, and what opportunities there are for further improvements. Erica Nelson is the director of the Race to Equity Project. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Thank you very much for having me today.
Sure. Thanks for joining us. First, can you tell us why the Race to Equity Project wanted to examine and compare these arrest rates?
Sure. The Race to Equity Project is a project, as you said, in the organization Kids Forward, and we focus on all the different areas of an individual and a family's well-being and look at that through a racial equity lens. And we look at economic well-being in the state and particularly in Dane County, where Madison is located, as well as education, the child welfare system, the adult criminal justice system, and the juvenile justice system. And oftentimes we see the racial disparities with families and children as compared to white families and children exist throughout. And so the juvenile justice system is oftentimes a reflection of these disparities for youth and families of color in particular.
And have you been tracking these numbers for quite a while, especially these juvenile justice numbers?
We have been tracking the reforms and the efforts within the juvenile justice system as an organization for many years. This report in particular is a more in-depth look looking at the differences in impact between youth of color and white youth in the state. And our findings over the years have shown that reform in the juvenile justice system has resulted in fewer youth involved in the juvenile justice system. However, the disparities between youth of color and white youth have not declined at such a fast pace as one would think they would.
Well, let's dig into some specifics. What disparities are you seeing, especially related to juvenile justice, between white youth and their African American and Native American peers?
Well, I think as you highlighted at the beginning, there's a disparity with respect to arrest rates, with respect to being sent to detention or incarceration. And I think you stated earlier that black youth are almost three times as likely to be arrested. Native American youth are two times as likely to be arrested. And African American youth are 15 times more likely to be incarcerated in the juvenile justice system. So we are seeing it sort of across the board from arrest all the way into detention and being placed in secure facilities.
Well, let's break that down a little. So there's the arrest rate, which, as you said, three times higher for African American youth, twice as high for Native American youth. There are those that would say, well, they must be doing more crimes. How would you respond to that?
Well, those perceptions are essentially false and I think are sort of grounded in unconscious bias. And in fact, what we see with respect to disparities and youth of color being disproportionately involved in the juvenile justice system is in many ways the result of contributing factors such as differential police policies and practices, where the offenses have taken place in terms of location, victims' perception of who is committing the crime, and having just sort of structural and institutional biases built into the system itself in terms of who the police target, how prosecutors charge, how courts rule. You know, the result is a racially unfair and essentially inequitable system that we believe needs to be fixed and addressed.
We're talking with Erica Nelson. She's the director of the Race to Equity Project. They just released a new report that looks at the arrest rates for youth in Wisconsin, dividing that up racially, finding that African American and Native American youth are arrested and incarcerated at higher rates. And so I want to go back to something you just said, Erica. You said it could have something to do from that, you know, looking at this as kind of a continuum where youth might first come in contact with police, then there might be an arrest, then there might be a conviction, then there would be sentencing or punishment. So let's go back to that very first part where there is contact with the police. You said it might have something to do with police policies and kind of priorities in where they're policing. What exactly does that look like in different communities, maybe a predominantly white community versus a predominantly African-American community?
Yeah, well, I think that for one, just to be clear, the policies that the police may have with respect to the communities is not an explicit policy, right? I'm sort of speaking to implicit unconscious bias that may exist in how we police and where we police. So oftentimes youth of color are more exposed to the system because of the communities in which they live. And while white youth are not, for instance, with respect to the arrest rate for drugs, right? Oftentimes, the exposure that kids of color have to the system based on the communities that they live in are already highly policed, and so that results in their likelihood of having more contact with the police. I think also there are circumstances when we look at the school-to-prison pipeline that people often talk about. If you have disparities within an education system that disproportionately pushes youth of color out of that system and involves them through suspension and expulsion, that they're more likely, again, to have a level of disproportionate contact with police and then subsequently involving them in later on in the juvenile justice system. If you look in the educational setting, oftentimes suspension and expulsion rates are very disproportionate, even for the same behavior. African-American youth and Native American youth are often suspended at a higher rate than white youth and their peers.
Have there been efforts to address some of these issues? Are there positive initiatives that you can point to that may make a difference in the coming years?
Well, I think there's a myriad of different things. I think, one, there has been a lot of work in the state of Wisconsin over the last few decades to work to improve our juvenile justice system. And in fact, the numbers overall in the aggregate have decreased significantly in terms of arrests, in terms of the number of kids committed. So that is something that is a positive. The question now becomes, how do we reduce the remaining disparities within the system so that these reforms are felt across the board for different racial and ethnic populations. That being said, there's been a lot of work in the state, and in particular in Dane County, around restorative justice programs, around more diversion from the system, in terms of looking to provide more comprehensive, holistic services for youth and families. I think there are policies in various districts looking at removing their zero tolerance policies, which are part of the policies that get kids out of school and more into the community and exposing them more to the police, which I just talked about. There have been a number of different reforms. There's been court reforms. There's been folks that have sort of begun to explicitly look at training around racial bias and implicit bias, and working with law enforcement and others within the system to understand the differential impact on youth of color. So I think there has been a lot of good work, and there are a lot of great, amazing individuals as well as communities and grassroots organizations who are working hard on this issue. And I think that going forward, I think with respect to the closing down of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake schools, that this also presents an opportunity for the state as a whole to look at what can we do more going forward to address the juvenile justice system and the disparities that we see. And go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, Erica.
So including sort of in more investment in mental health and trauma-informed care, looking at the role that the youth justice system plays with a focus on it being rehabilitative as opposed to punitive, figuring out what programs and supports can be implemented if a kid is in the system in order to provide them the tools and the support that they need to be productive community members, and sort of focusing on the youth's ability to take tools and an education out of the system and back into their community.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Erica. Erica Nelson is the director of the Race to Equity Project. She joined us to talk about their new report that found while arrest rates for white youth are declining, they're remaining steady for their Black and Native American peers. Stonehenge is one of the most iconic and mysterious sites from the ancient world that's still with us today. And this year, it's celebrating its 100th anniversary as a publicly owned property. Using new technology, researchers are making more discoveries about what rituals took place there and what the stones can tell us about the people who built it. Dave Potraz is one of WPR's network announcers and has been studying the history of the site for years. He's currently on vacation in England, and he talked with us earlier today live from Stonehenge. So tell us where you are and what you're seeing.
Well, I am, if you'll pardon the pun, just a stone's throw away from perhaps the most famous of ancient monuments in the world. And while some who come and visit here see it as just a pile of rocks, for many, many others, including me, it is so much more. Stonehenge lies in the midst of a rich archaeological landscape, contains major ancient earthworks and a myriad of other traces of prehistoric civilization from the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and all the way into the Iron Age.
Wow. Well, as you said, some people, I would like to think just a few, think of it as a big pile of rocks, but the rocks are pretty amazing. And those huge stones you told us are called sarsens. And that's, I think, what people picture. But there are also smaller stones at the site, and they're called bluestones. Tell us what we can learn from those bluestones.
Yes, that's right. The sarsens, of course, are what we think of when we think of Stonehenge. But within the sarsen circle, if you will, there are also a number of these blue stones, and more archaeologists and researchers are coming to realize that it may be perhaps the blue stones that carry the most ancient meaning, if you will, from the very beginning of the Stonehenge site itself.
So what do we know about the people who built Stonehenge?
Well, it's important to understand, of course, that Stonehenge is not just one monument built as a single event. It's actually many monuments constructed over more than 1,000 years.
Hmm.
And as such, it's been many things to many people, separated by time, and that's where the bluestones come in. It's one of the most intriguing enigmas about Stonehenge. The fact that the great mystery now is how in the world did they get here? You know, were they dragged, carried over land, keeping in mind that this was before wheeled transportation. Maybe they were brought by sea around the southern coast of Britain. Some say they might have been brought by glaciers. But here's the fascinating part. Here's the really fascinating part. Right now, archaeologists are testing the hypothesis that the bluestones may well have been derived from a pre-existing stone circle or other monument in the nearby Wales, so nearby the Welsh quarries that they were extracted from.
Hmm.
And they were uprooted and somehow transported more than 100 miles away. And this is where the people of Stonehenge come in. They're analyzing 5,000-year-old cremated human bones excavated here at Stonehenge, and they appear to have been buried adjacent to those possibly re-erected bluestones, moved from Wales, moved to the Stonehenge site, re-erected, and these bones have been found in the pits that held those stones. Now, what's really interesting is that as many as one-third of those buried here have been analyzed and are chemically consistent with people living 5,000 years ago in Western Britain, a region that includes Wales and the home of, you guessed it, the known source of the Stonehenge bluestone. So there's a real connection being drawn between that part of the country and right here in Wessex.
Wow, that really is fascinating. And what do we know about why Stonehenge is in the shape and arrangement that it is? Because it certainly seems very significant how those stones were placed.
Yeah, here's my take on that. Again, getting back to this idea that the bluestones may have been derived from a structure in Wales and then disassembled, carried piece by piece. There's about 80 stones or so that are the bluestones, carried here and set up within the circle earthwork that is the henge part of Stonehenge. And then I'm thinking, from what I've read and from what I've absorbed, that it might have been perhaps another version of the bluestone monument that was maybe further enhanced, if you will, or honored or memorialized by the addition of the much larger Sarsen stones, which occur naturally within this region, within about 20 miles away. So basically, they took a pre-existing stone circle and made it even more extravagant, even more elaborate, using local material and improved techniques.
Interesting. So the smaller stones might actually be the more significant stones, it sounds like.
That's what it's becoming to be understood more and more.
Dave Potraz is one of WPR's network announcers. You probably hear his voice many times a day. And he is also our resident expert on British archaeology, joining us from vacation at Stonehenge. And Dave, when you brought this idea to us, one of the things that just really struck me was you said that this year marks the 100th anniversary, many things about Stonehenge, we talk about thousands, but the 100th anniversary of Stonehenge becoming a publicly owned property. And before that, it was in private hands. So who gave Stonehenge to the British people?
It was purchased in 1915, I believe, by a local barrister, Cecil Chubb, and his wife, Mary. They bought it in 1915 from the previous owners, the Antrobus family. And the legend is that Mr. Chubb attended an auction with the intent of purchasing a set of dining room chairs.
And he came home with Stonehenge?
Yeah, came home with Stonehenge. Can you imagine? And then in 1918 it was, 100 years ago, that he gifted the land and Stonehenge to the English people. And now English Heritage is the steward of the property.
Well, Stonehenge is certainly a big attraction, but there are other important ritual sites in the area you're visiting, Dave, and one of them is Durrington Walls. Tell us about what we have learned about ancient feasting from that site.
This is, again, very interesting, and very recent excavations and research has been done on this. What archaeologists have recently discovered is that the area of Durrington Walls, which includes, I think you may have heard of Woodhenge, that's a wooden circle that kind of mimics the stone circle, that this was also connected to the River Avon by a short avenue, which means that the entire site took on a two-part ritual ceremonial significance. They're thinking now that one represented a place of the living, the wood, the other a place of the ancestors, the dead, stone. And here's the picture that they're painting. They would have massive feasts, massive festivities. We'd begin at the site at Durrington Walls. Abundant evidence has been found of extravagant feasting. And then the celebrants would commence down a processional route to the River Avon, all the way along, about 3 or 4 miles along the River Avon, before making their way up to the avenue, the long avenue to Stonehenge. And that site, of course, had already been used as a cemetery for 500 or 600 years. And they believe that their arrival was, we all hear of the summer solstice, people are celebrating the sun rising over Stonehenge and that axial alignment. But they're thinking now that the more significant might have been the winter solstice, the shorter day of the year. And they have evidence of that from the feasting remains that they have found at the area of Durrington Walls, massive middens, basically garbage pits of food waste. And they've been able to determine from the bone analysis from the animals that they were eating, was mainly pigs and beef, cattle, that they were culled in the fall so that they were eaten, possibly barbecued, the whole animal barbecued, and they were consumed in the fall, so that they believed that this processional was more aligned with the idea of the ending of the season, of the ending of the year. And so it was winter that the celebrants would participate in this long trip to Stonehenge. When they arrived, they would be just seeing the sun setting behind Stonehenge on the other side. You can see it clearly through the stones.
Wow. Well, Dave, as we wrap up briefly, you know, you told us that this is your third trip to Stonehenge. You've learned a lot about it over the years. What got you so interested in the history there?
Well, I'd sum it up in two words, lifelong learning. And, you know, that would sound gratuitous because that's what we're all about at public radio. But in this case, it's absolutely true. I visited here for the first time in the 1980s, had no idea what I was looking at. Then fast forward about 30 years, in 2008, I was actually listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show, and she had a British archaeologist who proceeded to describe all of the fascinating new research and all the field excavations that were going on here. So if lifelong learning is the goal, well, then at least for me, the Stonehenge landscape and beyond is a worthy candidate for study. You know, the terrific wealth of knowledge already gained here is only exceeded by really the treasure that's still hidden here and really waiting to be revealed. And I don't know if the term has been coined yet, so I'll do it. I think we're approaching what would you call a golden age of archaeology. There are so many methods now that were not available 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Archaeologists and researchers can find so much more about the people that lived here 5,000 years ago.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for taking time out of your vacation to share your passion with us, and have a great rest of your trip.
Thank you, Judith. Happy to do so.
Dave Potrez is one of WPR's announcers, and he talked with us earlier today live from Stonehenge about the new discoveries being made at one of the world's most famous sites. The late summer and early fall mean it's time for harvest festivals and parties with plenty of great food. One of those types of gatherings is the Swedish crayfish party. Yesterday, WPR teamed up with Al Johnson's restaurant in Door County for Crayfish Summerfest, which featured traditional Swedish food and drink, including strawberry cardamom shortbread and, of course, crayfish. To tell us more about Sweden's cooking and the culture of the crayfish party, we're joined by a few guests in our Green Bay studio. Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and Food Friday regular. Lori, hello.
Hi there. I'm surprised you can hear me. I'd really rather be drinking some more of that aquavit up in Door County right now.
Well, it must have really, you know, helped the pipes because you sound great. Rolf Johnson is co-owner of Al Johnson's Swedish restaurant in Sister Bay. Rolf, thanks for joining us also.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon.
And Freddie Bexell is the head chef at Al Johnson's. He also grew up in Sweden. Freddie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So, Lori, let's start with you. Yesterday, you were with Rolf and Freddie in Sister Bay for the WPR Crayfish Summerfest. What was the atmosphere like?
This was a very happy party. There were somewhere between 150 and 200 people at tables. The tent was strung with brilliant paper lanterns. Everybody was wearing paper hats with images of the sun and the moon and crayfish on them. This is a very casual party. You're meant to roll up your sleeves, rip the crayfish apart with your hands, and enjoy great food and a lot of great conversation. I gather, gentlemen, the idea of a crayfish party is this is the last big outdoor party in Sweden before we have to start worrying about there's no more sunshine. So this is a big deal in Sweden, isn't it?
Very big deal. It's as we know, the days are getting shorter starting in June, and they're looking forward to that. We're not looking forward to the long, dark winter. And we notice that the days are getting shorter more so in August when the sun starts setting a little earlier. So it's their last big hurrah.
Absolutely.
Well, and Freddie, tell us about what kind of food is involved. If we're in Sweden and we happen to be lucky enough to get an invitation to a crayfish dinner, what kind of food can we expect besides, you know, that centerpiece of the crayfish?
Most of the time, it's actually mostly crayfish and some bread and some cheese, and of course the aquavit. Sometimes, depending on all, every family has their own tradition. You know, I mean, we added the dill potatoes and the corn because it's Wisconsin, so we needed sweet corn.
Absolutely.
And Rolf, tell us about aquavit, because a couple of you have now mentioned that.
Aquavit is a staple item at the Kräftskiva. That's what they say in Sweden for the crayfish fest. And it's an alcohol. It's a schnapps, or schnapps, as you say here. And it's flavored with different types of herbs. Ours is flavored with orange rind.
Orange peel, yeah, yeah. Cardamom.
And so we make our own in-house, and it's quite the hit. I like to tease other Swedes, and Freddie especially, that if it wasn't for the aquavit, that a lot of Swedes wouldn't get to know each other.
Now, one of the interesting things about aquavit is in the current climate of craft cocktails, this is still not something that really gets used as a mixer in any cocktails. You still want it to be drunk the way we were drinking it last night. You have a couple of crayfish, and then you take your shot of schnapps. The idea being, this is grain and potato-based alcohol, but it has those herbs in it. There is some would say, all right, the FCC or the FDA hasn't weighed in on it, but there is something medicinal about it. This does help your digestion, having alcohol with herbs and spices in it to just make everything go down easier.
Yeah, no difference than people are drinking bitters here.
Exactly.
Interesting. So I have to say the orange and cardamom combo sounds delicious to me. But Freddie, are there some other herbal combinations that we might find in our aquavit?
Once again, every family that makes their own have their own recipes. I mean, our bar manager, Bryn, she has made various, I mean, she has been playing around with it for a while. So there's a couple of them that has caraway seeds in it and fennel. And so it's, like I said, it's kind of the same tradition as the crayfish itself. Every family has their own.
Wow, that they all sound delicious. And, yeah, I can see how you'd need something to wash down those crayfish. Well, Lori, you mentioned that the crayfish party is, you know, traditionally held in August. It's kind of a harvest festival. But that thinking of crayfish as the harvest really kind of plays with our idea of what we're usually harvesting and maybe having for, say, a Thanksgiving dinner.
When we say harvest, and you're like me, you've grown up on a farm, you always think of, what did I just harvest out of the dirt?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, whether it's crayfish or cranberries, a great deal of harvesting has to do with what's in the water. So there's a great sense of the season and how you're working with it, the optimum time to be out in the water, getting that harvest in. Now, in Sweden, it's a little bit difficult these days to find crayfish, isn't it?
It has been really hard. And, you know, they've been importing crayfish from Turkey and Thailand, but also from Louisiana. But it's slowly starting to come back in the waters in Sweden for the last couple of years now. So it's more popular to get
the sign of a healthy lake is a lot of crayfish, right?
Yes.
Well, and I was going to ask Freddie, what was the cause of that crash of the crayfish population?
A lot of them had disease. It spread all the way through because the whole country is full of small lakes, so it spread fairly quickly and pretty much killed off all the crayfish.
So are crayfish only freshwater?
No. Yes.
Well,
in Sweden they are, but
okay.
Yeah.
Great. We are talking with three guests from our Green Bay studios, Lori Skelton, WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. We also have Rolf Johnson, who's co-owner of Al Johnson's Swedish restaurant in Sister Bay, and Freddie Bexell, who's the head chef at Al Johnson's. We are talking about Swedish cuisine, specifically crayfish dinners. Yesterday, WPR hosted a dinner there in Sister Bay, and sounds like it was a great party. I'm sorry that I was down here for it. Well, Freddie, let's talk about how you prepare the crayfish. How are these? How do you get them ready to bring to the table?
So we boil them in dark beer, water, salt and sugar, and a lot of dill crowns.
That's important. Dill crown is the dill after it has floured. So that is going to give the dill a much I guess the best word is assertive taste rather than feathery green dill. If dill has flowered, it's got a punch to it.
Hmm. Yeah, it's almost more towards like the pickling part of it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which again ties in with the brine aspect of it. And you mentioned dark beer. Not everybody uses beer in their brine. Why do you use beer?
That's just something that we did in my family. That's how mom did it. So, you know, and most of the time in Sweden, it's, you know, you drink lighter beer like a lager, but somehow she always liked the darker part for her crayfish, so that's how I learned.
Wow.
It sounds like there's a lot of tradition built into really kind of every aspect of these crayfish dinners.
It was something I heard so often from the guests at the party last night, whether they were Swedish themselves or whether they just still had family and friends in Sweden and they'd taken part in these dinners themselves in Sweden. Everybody I talked to got a little bit misty-eyed with the idea that there is so much goodwill and community building around this relatively simple supper. Hmm. Boiled crayfish and bread and cheese and a little bit of schnapps, but there is something that is really strong about, yeah, it's simple, but we do it every year and we do it as a community, we do it with our friends. There was something very, very powerful in everybody's reminiscence about what they had had before and how thrilled they were that they got to do it in Door County this year.
And that's how it's been in Sweden, too. Like I said, it's always hard to find crayfish, but the people that had it were always happy to share it because it was such an old tradition with everybody there. So even if you only had a couple, you would make sure that your neighbors got some to share it as well.
Very community building.
No wonder.
And Freddie, is this a meal that people would have at their homes, or is this something they would have when they were actually out at the lakes and maybe, you know, scooping up those crayfish right then?
At their summer homes or whatever, most of the time, yes.
So that probably really adds to the atmosphere as well.
Absolutely.
And Rolf, so we've got the crayfish boiled, sounds great, the dill head or crown, the dark beer, the sugar, the salt. So there they are, ready to come to the table, and they're in their shells. For crayfish novices, how do you eat them?
Well, everybody's got a different way. The way I was taught, off come the claws first, and some places have a tool to get it out, but of course, you got to roll up your sleeves. You don't want to wear anything nice. You don't want to wear a white shirt.
We were all wearing bibs last night.
Yeah, the bibs come in handy, and Swedes are pretty timid. But when it comes to a crayfish party, they let their guard down. And then you usually split open the bottom, and there's a lot of slurping or sucking sounds going on because you want to suck the juice out first, and then it becomes basically a peel-and-eat item.
And I know that, like, when you cook shrimp in their shells, they get so much more flavor, and the shell really adds a lot. Freddie, is that the same thing with the crayfish?
Yes, absolutely.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about Swedish cooking with Lori Skelton, Rolf Johnson, and Freddie Bexell. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you gone to a crayfish party, either here in Wisconsin or in Sweden? What made it special? Do you have a favorite Swedish dish that's been passed down in your family? Or do you have a creative way to use some of the foods we're talking about, like crayfish? And we'll be talking more about cardamom and delicious shortbreads. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. We're picking up our talk with Lori Skelton, Rolf Johnson, and Freddie Bexell, looking at Swedish cooking and crayfish parties. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is Swedish cooking part of your family's heritage? What are some of your favorite dishes? If you've been to a crayfish party before, give us a call and tell us about it. And what makes food traditions important to you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Well, Lori, you and I have something in common that I didn't know until today. We are both big fans of cardamom, and we'll look at in a minute at strawberry cardamom shortbread, which made an appearance at yesterday's event. But for people who might not use it much or not be sure what the flavor is like, how would you describe it and how do you like to use it?
Cardamom is a spice that is native to India, and like cinnamon, which it is sometimes paired with, it has a warming quality to it. The difference between cardamom and cinnamon is that cardamom also has a slight menthol undertone when it's ground, especially when it's ground. You can find cardamom either in the whole pods, which are toasted before you break open to get the black seeds and are sometimes used whole, but very often cardamom is those black seeds ground. And that's where you need to be a little bit careful with it. Cardamom can overwhelm things, but use it well, use it in good balance with your other flavors, and I think it's one of the most magical things out there. And one thing that I love about cardamom in Scandinavian cooking, certainly in Swedish cooking, yeah, it's a no-brainer for sweet things. Substitute some cardamom in your cinnamon rolls next time you make them. But cardamom in savory dishes is out of this world. Mm. And we were talking just before we went on air about how you can use it for, say, cauliflower. It's not good with every brassica, but it's great with cauliflower. It's great with carrots. And if you're working, say, with a winter squash and you're used to cinnamon and butter or brown sugar, you may want to try cardamom the next time and change your game up. But cardamom makes an appearance. All right, you've mentioned the aquavit, but it made an appearance on the Al Johnson's table last night with the dessert, with the shortbread.
And Freddie, let's talk about that strawberry cardamom shortbread. And I will say that I've been known to put cardamom seeds in my coffee, the coffee grounds, before I make my coffee. So my coffee gets infused with cardamom. And I got to believe that that would go pretty well with this strawberry cardamom shortbread. Tell us how we make the shortbread.
Well, it's another family tradition of mine. My grandma used to make sweet rolls with cardamom in it, and when I started working in Al's, I was keep hinting to our baker that you need to start making this cardamom bread. So he started making a couple. It's only been a couple of years, actually, since he started making it, and it's been very popular, even though I eat most of it myself, to be honest.
And what we were eating last night, I normally think of shortbread as a very buttery, crumbly cookie. And as you say, what we had last night was almost more of a tea bread. It was very pale and beautiful and had a lovely soft crumb. Mary Berry would have called that one of the best cakes she's ever eaten.
Would she have said it was scrummy?
Yes, she would have said it was scrummy. It was scrummy, beautifully flavored with cardamom. Again, not overwhelming, and it perfumed those strawberries even, you know, just from the cake itself. It was amazing.
Perfumed is a good word for it because I think of cardamom as a very aromatic spice to use. And we do have the recipe for cardamom shortbread at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, something that Swedes and Wisconsinites can agree on is cheese. And Rolf, Västerbotten cheese is one that pops up at crayfish parties. Tell us about it.
Freddie's got to share that with you. I don't know a lot about the Swedish cheeses. I know I love to eat them. And when he brought them out there, and I was always used to the Bondust that we used to have growing up, but Freddie has introduced me to way more cheeses than I knew existed.
Well, Freddie, why don't you jump in?
One of the cheeses we had last night was an aged priest cheese, which I buy once in a while, I should say, mostly for myself, but we also have it, so we sell it in the restaurant. We use it for sandwiches as well.
Now, last week, I brought in, not aged, but I was able to find some priest cheese, had it sent to me, and it starts off tasting like Parmesan, and the finish is more like cheddar. The combination was mind-blowingly delicious.
It was really good. I really liked it. It had a very fresh flavor, but a very fresh but very buttery kind of flavor to it.
Yeah. So rumor has it that you can get either that cheese or possibly the Vesterbutten at IKEA. Now, I've yet to see it at the one in Oak Creek, but maybe if we keep our fingers crossed, is this possible?
Yes, it is. Vesterbotten is more, it's harder to get. The Priest cheese, it's usually easier. I haven't had any luck getting this aged Priest cheese in a while. It's a little bit stronger. It's more crumbly. The Priest cheese normally is pretty creamy, almost like the Bundost, the farmer's cheese.
So are you saying Priest like a Catholic priest?
Yes.
Okay. But it's not spelled anywhere near
okay.
it.
No. Okay. but it's a homonym. Okay. I want to make sure I was hearing that.
Yes.
Right.
So it's prestost in Swedish.
Okay. So, Freddie, I know in a lot of northern climates, mushrooms are a really popular ingredient, and I hear that that is true for Sweden as well. Is first of all, is mushroom foraging part of Swedish culture?
Chanterelles is very popular as well, just kind of like it is here. You just have to know the right person that can have the spot for you.
And share it with nobody.
Yeah. Okay. Share it with nobody, that's right.
Mm. And how do you use them in Swedish cooking?
Just slowly saute them in butter. I mean, I'd like them just on a piece of limpa toast, just like salt and pepper and butter.
So simple, but a real way to showcase the flavor.
Yes.
I know, getting back to that Vesterbutten cheese, I know a lot of people will make a quiche-type pie with that cheese and chanterelles. I was trying to come up with a sturdier crust, like a raised pie with caraway and dill and just mushrooms and cream. I was going for Swedish flavors. I couldn't quite get the right consistency of pie. So I think I have one of my projects for this winter out before me. See if I can get a sort of a Swedish pie without a recipe.
That's actually a very traditional dish that goes with the crayfish, especially when you get the northern part of Sweden. It's the Vesterbotten pie.
Mushroom pie?
No, the Vesterbotten, especially that cheese to go with crayfish, because it's a very strong cheese.
Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly what we had last night was delicious.
Michael from Fitchburg wanted to add that he's been to Stockholm many times, and his favorite dish is called fisksoppa, which is like a fish stew. And so it does definitely seem like there is a theme of the bounty of the water that plays into Swedish cuisine.
Absolutely. Like, cod has always been a big part of Swedish cuisine, just because it's everywhere. And it's easy to get and fairly cheap.
Freddie, I wanted to ask you about, we are very affected by where we live. And one of the things about Sweden, especially as you were saying, getting up into northern Sweden, is that there is a very big difference in how much daylight there is, say, in June versus, say, November. And how would you say that that difference and that cycle influences Swedish cooking?
I don't know if it's so much influence of the cooking per se, but like Rolf talked about, like the crayfish part, it's like end of summer, like, okay, this is our last party outside, but it's like the days are getting very short, but you know what's coming, and especially up north, you know, it gets dark really, really quick in the afternoon. I had a coworker that worked in the northern tip of Sweden, and it said that it was... The sun came up for like 2 hours and winked at you, and then when it was dark again.
And briefly, before we wrap up, Rolf, you know, what do you think it is about food that is so evocative of our cultural traditions and our ties to our culture?
Oh, I think every culture has that camaraderie building food that they can recall. If it's in Sweden, it's the kräftskiva, the crayfish party. I've been to other many countries, and if you participate in their traditions, you're going to feel much more welcome. They're going to accept you more easily. And I think everybody, even up here in Wisconsin, the farming communities have similar things with their bountiful harvests at the end of their seasons.
Well, Rolf, Freddie, and Lori, what a fun conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us on, Judith. This was a treat.
That was WPR's Lori Skelton, also Rolf Johnson and Freddie Bexell of Al Johnson's Swedish Restaurant in Sister Bay. They were talking with us about crayfish parties and some of their favorite Swedish dishes and celebrations. Well, we just heard about a very light and cheery Swedish food tradition, but I've found myself drawn to another side of Scandinavian life, and that's the world of Nordic noir. There's a whole genre that stretches from Iceland across to Finland and down to Denmark that peels back what seems to be the normal, almost bland top layer of society to the seedy and dark underbelly just below the surface. A lot of people were introduced to it through the Stieg Larsson trilogy that includes The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Henning Mankell's books centering on Detective Kurt Wallander are also a good entry point. And Ursa Sigurdardottir's novels make her home country of Iceland practically one of the main characters in her stories. Nordic noir stories often involve a gruesome crime, and police officers are detectives, but psychologists also make regular appearances. And they're usually in pursuit of a pretty twisted criminal, often across a desolate northern landscape. If you're more a fan of watching than reading, there are series like the original Danish version of The Killing, the Finnish series Border Town, or Sweden's series The Missing and Modus. So if you're looking to be transported to northern climes and don't mind your entertainment on the dark side, you might want to give Nordic noir a try. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then Governor Scott Walker and opponent Tony Evers aren't wasting any time in getting their campaigns underway. We'll talk about what the candidates are up to. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.